Muller House Meeting, Sunday morning, 25th of September, 1977. The brain is the synthesizer of all the impressions that come to us from outside, or which arise from within our own organism. By synthesizer, I am implying an emphasis upon the mechanical aspect. Synthesizing, in this sense, is just a putting together of different pieces in order to make something which is always finite. It comes into being, it comes to an end. The brain is not a true integrator in the living sense. That is to say, it does not build into your inner being that which represents the true growth, the living growth of your inner being. Its activity is a little bit mechanical as compared with what is living and organic. The brain doesn't develop your faculties. It is mind, in its transcendent sense, the creative power which releases faculty, which spells your growth. It's important to remember this. Now, the brain is a wonderful computer. It is a wonderful pigeonholer. It puts everything into its particular pigeon according to the impressions you have received from moment to moment. It sort of collects all the impressions in a card index. You see? And these mental constructs have a very powerful effect upon our lives. The brain is it's the realm of relativity, of dualism, of either this or that. And the brain stores up everything in terms of memory. And it is the brain which gives the power which we human beings have, not only of remembering the past and calling up out of this card index collection what we want to recall, but it also has the ability, by logical deduction, to anticipate a future, to wish for a future, look to a future. The result of this is that memory and anticipation capture our attention far more than the present, the past and the future. We are constantly living in terms of the past and the future. Instead of being completely attentive to the immediate present. That's what I mean by saying it's the realm of relativity. So it is always the realm of that which is mortal, that which belongs to a beginning and an ending, which are associated with pleasure and pain, with joy and sorrow, with confusion and a momentary enlightenment. So we raise up our values of good and evil and the conflict between them, of virtue and vice. And because all these ideas and concepts arise out of experience in the realm of the temporal, that which stays only for a time and passes away, because it arises out of that realm, we do not get outside. We cannot escape this circle, this closed circle of mortality. But there is something in us which seeks immortality. Only it seeks it in the wrong way because of our state of ignorance. The brain will do the mechanical thinking part, but the brain cannot give rise to true inspiration or creative activity. It is mind in which the brain is contained, which is the source of inspiration, of creative activity. And it is the mind in actual fact which sees totally and truly, sees things in wholeness and not partially. The brain makes us take sides with what we like, what gives us pleasure or satisfaction, against what we dislike, gives us displeasure or dissatisfaction. Therefore, the brain never meditates, never can meditate. You remember, we considered this yesterday. Transcendence minding, that is, transcendence creating, is the real meaning and state of meditation. And in us, finite human beings, meditation comes into being when the brain is quiet and silent. Now, what I have said may make us feel the brain is our enemy. It isn't. It isn't our enemy. It is an instrument which, whilst we haven't awakened from within, hinders us from realizing our true destiny as man, the living image of God. But it is also, the brain is also, the indispensable instrument, the indispensable link between the organism and transcendence. Now, you know, in the original teachings, which sprang up somewhere between, say, Egypt and the Nile Valley and the Himalayan region. All that region across the Fertile Crescent and so forth. In the original teachings, when they represented the tree of life, when they represented the ultimate reality in the form of man, the divinely conceived man, the divine concept man, not just these organisms, when they represented that transcendence in the process of its creation and manifestation as man, both great traditions, the Western Semitic, I don't mean by Western European, but the Semitic tradition and the Indian tradition, both presented the brain as the seat where transcendence touches and enters into the mortal man. The immortal makes its entry through there. Now don't understand this merely physically. This is only a painting, a symbol, a suggestion that this is the doorway of connection. In actual fact, the doorway of connection is through your total being, your total body. The life of every cell of the body, that life is transcendent life. It never dies. The body will die, that means it will stop functioning, and then the parts will leave, and this particular body will be no more. You see? But this mysterious thing, life, this mysterious thing, the material through which life manifests, is indestructible. We all know that. You see? So now, you must remember that this is just a symbolical way of talking. But there is this very important point in connection with it, that the brain physically is certainly the synthesizing agent, you see, and the producer of duality and or the conflict involved and all the rest of it, and the preventer of transcendence functioning freely through that which is dual by nature. Now, the brain being what it is not, and functioning as it is not in the pure state, the clean state. As and when the brain and its activity can be seen by your own inward vision to be what it truly is, then it ceases to be your master. Now, you are the user of that brain. And the brain will obey you. It will be quiet. It's not like the servant who runs the house, but the mistress of the house who runs the house. It'll be like that. You see? And when, through the discipline of the religious life, the living of the holy life, the whole psyche has been understood, fully understood, and thereby fully healed, then the state of innocence completely pervades the whole body, the brain particularly, and the whole psyche. Now, what is this state of innocence? Except ye become as little children again, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. Let the little children come to me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus was not referring to all the little boys and girls running about and shouting and making such a nuisance of themselves sometimes and being such little darlings at other times. He was referring to you and to me through our purification, having come back again to the state of purity, of innocence. The state of purity is one in which you as yourself, or through you as the agent, do no harm to anybody or anything. The innocence, nocens, the Latin, hurting, harming. No more hurting, no more harming. Now do realize that in this extraordinary state, one has become so open to everything and everybody that whatever harm, whatever pain comes, you take into yourself. And because you are innocent, you have infinite virtue in you. Above all, the reality of love. We don't know what love is. We talk about love. But that state of love is not an emotion. It is not a passion. It is not an idea. It is a state of being in which we are completely harmless. And in that harmless state, the power of vision, which at its peak point is called omniscience, arises within us at the same time. This is the innocent state. And in this state of innocence, the brain no longer shuts the doors against transcendence, meditating. And then you are truly in the state of constant meditation. And remember, the profoundest meaning of meditation is communion, the state of communion. Because you are in the state of communion within yourself, therefore you are also in the state of communion with the outside world. When we function ordinarily as ordinary human beings, making mistakes, we may perhaps feel at times that we are at peace and in communion within ourselves. But notice what happens when some unpleasant stimulus comes from outside. The brain immediately reacts against it. Or if some pleasant thing comes from outside and captures your attention, the brain again immediately reacts and says, oh, I like this, I'll have it. And you are out of the innocent state. In the innocent state, you are so utterly peaceful, you are so utterly quiet, that all the turmoil of the outside world, to which you are fully sensitive, no longer upsets you or spoils your innocence, the harmless state. In actual fact, the organism is always in communion with the total universe. You remember, we considered this point briefly. The self exists because of the not-self. The total cosmos, all the energies of the cosmos, produced you, produced me, sustains and maintains you, sustains and maintains me. And that is the state of communion also. That also is the state of communion. If there wasn't this flow of life and energy throughout each and everything and between us and the whole universe, we wouldn't exist. You see? So, unconsciously, there is this state of communion. But the brain, until it has become innocent, until the psyche has become innocent, this is what causes the quarrel between the not-self and the self. And the state of innocence disappears. The smile on the face of the child turns into tears. You see? There is another state in which we regain our innocence almost every day of our lives. And that is in deep slumber. You know, when you go to sleep, you have, science knows about this now, through its researchers this century. When you go to sleep, your sleep consists of two main aspects. One aspect is where you go through the dream state, the dreaming sleep. You have dreams. What's happening? The brain is churning up the impressions of the day, all the reactions during the day and so forth. Again, outside influences like thunder and lightning or whatever may touch your body or something in sleep and so on and so on, they all produce these dreams. And there is the other aspect of sleep in which there are no dreams. The whole psychophysical organism has once again become so relaxed, so peaceful, that it is in the innocent, the harmless state. You watch a little child or you watch a grown-up in really deep slumber. How utterly peaceful, how utterly harmless that person is. You see? So we experience that harmlessness in deep slumber. But whilst the good effect of it is that the whole body is recharged with vitality, we cannot sort of bring the benefit of that to us in such a way that transcendence meditating remains transcendence meditating when we wake up. When we wake up, the brain once again starts the whole noise and business of daily life, as we call it. So, in the process of our spiritual unfoldment, so that we can live in communion through the 24 hours of the day, the discipline of the religious life, whose most important aspect is the purity of everyday life, that plays its part. Then, when the brain is free from the conflict of memory and anticipation, when the brain is free of reacting helplessly to every stimulus and situation and circumstance, then we are truly in the state of communion. Then too we are truly in the state of silence. Because this helpless reaction means that the organism is disturbed and is causing disturbance. See? Now this is the discipline of the religious life, therefore, is the true meaning of self-restraint. Nothing which is done forcibly. If you try to compel yourself, another part of the psyche will rebel against it. It's like a seesaw then. Now, a seesaw state is not a state of real harmony, real balance. You see? Because if something comes, falls at this end of the seesaw, up goes that end. If something falls at that end of the seesaw, up goes this end. So you are always in a state of disturbance. There's no repression. There is no suppression. Whatever comes, whether you are happy and elated and so forth, or whether you're sorrowful and deeply depressed, and you think that, oh, there is no cure for this and so forth, just watch it carefully. Watch it, watch it. And you will find that you will be free, you will naturally grow free of this seesaw state. And then your balance will no longer need a fulcrum, you know, the central point on which you're balancing the bar, which goes up and down, but you will move freely through space without needing anything to hold you up. What holds you up? This mysterious power, take the physical analogy, which we call gravitation. Gravity, this power of gravity, holds the whole cosmos in a wonderful harmony and order. The force of gravity. And the earth just dances through space. Nothing holds the earth up but this attractive power of the sun. And the earth makes her movement absolutely wonderfully. And that is how you will be balanced. And in being balanced like that, whatsoever happens in the sphere of your earth, which is this, the body itself, whatsoever happens within the sphere of your psychophysical organism will be a harmony and a balance and a perfect activity, the perfect movement. Life will dance, make you dance round and round that central sun, the vision and the fact of the enlightened state, the meditative state. You see? So we must be very careful to give brain its proper place. And remember this point of innocence, the harmlessness. We said yesterday that the real meaning of meditation is communion, the state of constant communion. A constant communion not just with the brain sort of saying to itself, oh, I am one with the universe is one with me and all that. That is all talk. And it just raises up illusory pictures in imagination. It promotes vanity in us. It very subtly increases our egoism. I am one of the chosen ones. As long as that concept of I comes to the forefront, then be quite sure that you are not progressing in meditation, but you are regressing, going backwards into subhumanity. This imposition of the I, the self, upon the not-self. There are all sorts of subtle dangers which you have to beware of. Now, you remember I said yesterday afternoon, no one can teach me to meditate. But others can assist me to enter the state of meditation. And the principal influence from outside, as well as from inside in the rare good moments, the principal influence is one which enables me to become the psyche, to become more and more pure. Then it gets free of the conflict between what I, in my restricted state, call virtue and vice. In the harmless state, the innocent state, there is no virtue, there is no vice. You look at the new child, the newborn child, it's in a state of innocence, but it is unconscious innocence. It is the state of innocence which can be poisoned, and unhappily it does get poisoned with practically the whole of mankind as we grow up. Because our parents, unfortunately, are not perfect human beings. Our teachers, our friends, our society are not perfect human beings. We are so imperfect that we think in terms of friends and enemies, forgetting, I call him my friend, I call him my enemy. But they are both my fellow human beings. That is the fact of nature, and I deny that fact by taking sides with my friend against an enemy, producing the state which is not innocent, the harmful state. You see? So, these influences, when they do come from outside, which help us to see things more truly, first with the brain, now the brain becomes indispensable, because otherwise we can't communicate if the brain is not at work, you see. These things which make us more and more pure in our daily life are the things which assist us to enter finally into the state of meditation. In actual fact, we don't make the entry as a deliberate decision on our part. It is a two-way traffic. Transcendence no longer finds anything obstructing its entry into you. You are open to transcendence, and your movement is the movement of opening out, the complete opening out of the mind and the purified heart. You see? But the movement that I can make, because I'm such a little thing, a speck of human dust in the universe, my movement, my power of such movement is so small, so little. But the power of the movement of transcendence is so mighty, it completely takes you in. There is such bliss in that state. When suddenly transcendence takes you in like that, in those magical moments when the whole organism is at least for the time being innocent, the bliss of it is indescribable. It is not a sensational disturbance. It is not an emotional ecstasy. It is not a triumph of deliberate effort which makes you enter a particular deep state of consciousness, howsoever deep it may be. Don't be misled by these things. You see? It is that blissful state of utter union, when the distinction between conscious and unconscious in one's own psyche is completely gone. So instead of there being the what we commonly call in modern terms the conscious mind and the unconscious mind, there is only mind, the total, the whole mind, which is all light, all enlightenment. So you see, if we bear these things in mind, we will be free from misdirecting our energies. Normally, we direct all our energies to gain something for ourselves. Then you will cease to misdirect energies. And then you will find extraordinary things happening. You can take pain and pleasure, sorrow and joy in your stride. You will be wholly sensitive to it, but you will also be wholly happy in it. This is a happiness that has no relationship with pleasure. You will no longer seek pleasure, grasp pleasure, seek comfort, security, fulfillment as defined by yourself. But you will be the instrument, the pure instrument of fulfillment of transcendence itself. Then, what we call the Holy Grail, if you like, is your own being. Call it the Garden of Eden, if you like. You once again are Lord and Lady of that Garden of Eden. You see, the state of complete and utter communion is restored that way. So now, influences from outside. What are these influences from outside? The important ones, which, because they help you, you may regard as your teachers, if you are prepared to learn. If you are willing to learn, no one can teach you. If you're willing to learn, everyone and everything teaches you, because you are learning from that. You can always shut the doors of the brain against any teacher. We all know that from our school days. I don't like my teacher, so I go off in my imagination, riding donkeys or chasing butterflies or climbing mountains and so on, don't we? We can shut the door against the teacher, the man. We can shut the doors of the soul and all the windows against the whole of nature. Now you'll appreciate why this meditative walking is just one example, has a remarkable effect. If you walk meditatively, move, that is to say, move about in the world of everyday life meditatively, in the spirit of the open mind and heart, and in the spirit of that observation, that calm observation where the brain doesn't say, oh, this is good, I like it, this is bad, I don't like it, and so on and so on, of calm and pure observation, then all the time there will be a learning taking place. And that learning may take the form of ideas and words and concepts, but deeper than the words and ideas and concepts will be the release of the sleeping powers of the mind inside your own psyche. Then you will find an extraordinary opening out of the whole psyche. The real deep powers and the deep knowledge which overflows the boundaries of the cup or box of concepts and so forth takes place. This overflowing. And you know with a knowing that is not the acquisition of ideas or anything like that, but you know by your own psyche, your own mind and consciousness becoming that which you know. Now look, when I go out, a tree is my teacher. If I look at the tree with myself quiet and at peace, if I really look at that tree that way, the mind takes over, the psyche is quiet, there are no reactions, I am paying full attention goes out to the tree, and then that tree is seen. I have to use the word seen because we have no words in any language to express this kind of seeing. That tree is seen in a totally different way. You sort of know the tree by becoming the tree in your own mind. It's not as if the psyche and the brain were looking at a tree there. That's a tree, I am so and so, looking at the tree. The separation between the tree and yourself vanishes. This is the establishment, the growth, the living growth of the state of communion. Now you are in communion. And the nature of that communion you don't know in the ordinary way, because there are no words to describe it. Words and concepts are merely photographs of the living thing. This is the extraordinary thing that happens. This is the actual experience of love in its transcendence in actual manifestation. What is love? It is this state of union, this state of complete unity, the unity of the universe, which is not spoilt or hurt by the individual self. So, you know the tree in a totally different way. And you learn in an extraordinary manner. You listen to a piece of music. The same thing can happen. If the brain is quiet and doesn't say, oh, Klemperer conducted this much better than so and so, this person sang, oh, no one like her, the one most wonderful soprano, these... What's happening? You're in a state of turmoil. What is happening now. Pay total attention to it with the self quiet, and divinity will manifest through your attentiveness, through your pure attentiveness, which means the state of complete innocence of the psyche and the brain. So, the music becomes my teacher. I'm learning from it all. Learning, translate learning to mean growing happily. Don't associate pleasure with this happiness. This is a divine happiness. You see, growing happily is learning. A tree. Now, do you look at a tree? It stands upright. It doesn't blame its circumstances for anything that it may have to suffer. It doesn't say, oh, the ground is not level, the soil is not very good, I won't grow here, or I'll move out somewhere. It just doesn't. It just works in harmony with all the forces of nature that are present. Do we do that? Oh, I haven't got the right kind of office, I haven't got the right kind of house, I haven't got this, that and the other, can't do this business here, etc. We're all the time grumbling. Now, how different that tree is. How much do I learn from it? We have all seen little plants begin to grow up, the grass growing up out of what looks like solid rock. Look at the way the plants grew up after the bombing of cities, when everything was, it seemed as if nothing can possibly grow here. But inside 2 years, I have seen with my own eyes in London, little plants growing out of that rubble heap. How do they do it? They don't complain. They just grow like that. So you see, one learns so much if one just uses one's senses rightly in the state of innocence. Then you will find that all the senses are the cords of communion, the channels of communion. Without the senses functioning in that way, there is no possibility of living in communion. All right. So too, a blade of grass teaches me. What do we do when we have difficulties? We fight against them. We resist them. Here is a blade of grass happily standing upright. There is a storm. The grass doesn't complain to some higher authority that the storm is doing this to me, stop him, stop it from doing this. The blade of grass merely does that. And when the storm is over, the blade of grass comes up again. It's infinitely resilient, infinitely elastic. I walk over grass. The grass gets trampled upon, and in a few seconds it is up again. Infinitely resilient. Now, if we can become infinitely resilient, elastic, being able to take wholly and give wholly, would there be wars and strikes? And the evil that man does against his fellow man, who is of his very substance and his very nature. What is the good of peace conferences and all the rest of it? What happens at a peace conference? A number of people get together, and the so-called victorious people extract everything that they can from the people who have not won the victory. What's the result? You know your history. I have read a little bit of world history. And every time, every peace treaty ultimately gets broken. And it is useless. But if you and I are peaceful and innocent, it is impossible to be at war. Look at the saving in expense anyway. You see how it is. We are the source of all our institutions, the state of affairs of the world. And we are always blaming the other person, the government, or the laws, or this, that, or the other. Would there be terrorism if we were peaceful within ourselves? We have been called by scientists the species Homo sapiens. Man, the knowing one, in the sense of the wise one. Are we not more truly described as we are, as Homo stultus, stupid, and Homo criminalis, criminal? That is the fact. How do we become sapient? How do we become Homo sapiens? By first seeing the fact about ourselves. And when you see that, oh, this is criminal, this is foolish, this is evil, when you really see it, the light from within enables you to immediately have the faculty of dropping criminality and folly. It just falls off you. You know, if something hurts the skin, and when it heals, or whilst it is healing, there is what we call a scab on the skin. And when that part is healed, what happens? The scab just falls off. You don't have to fight against the scab. Get the idea? The very body itself is my wonderful teacher. And a teacher of true meditation, of true observation. Now, one word about this aspect of meditation. This is what we call in India, mindfulness, perfect mindfulness, samasati, that is to be aware, alert, awake, and free of our petty values, good, bad, this, that, and the other. As we change, as we grow in life, our ideas of what is good and bad change. Then which were the true ideas? What is the truth? We really don't know, you see. This mindfulness, this observation of everything through all our senses, and therefore also this responding to everything that is observed through the senses, responding, not reacting, reacting for or reacting against. The true response comes out, and this kind of mindfulness is meditation at our levels. No one can teach you this, because who is paying attention? You, your teacher of meditation, cannot be attentive on your behalf. You have to be attentive. That is exclusively your responsibility and your action. Just as nobody else can digest food on my behalf. If I employed somebody to eat and digest for my behalf, there'll be a funeral inside a few weeks. Wouldn't there? It's like that. We must recognize what our real duties are. This mindfulness, this constant mindfulness, and faculty grows, and the barriers between transcendence and oneself disappear. And as they disappear, the purification and realization within takes place. This goes out as an influence on the environment. and you live in communion with the environment. Now this mindful state is the state which is really a 24-hour meditation. The sort of specific states which you experience when you deliberately sit quiet or are alone by yourself and so forth are also aspects of meditation, but those come by grace of transcendence. It's transcendence minding, transcendence creating, which enters your organism freely. When mindfulness, which is the constant meditation you can practice, has come to fruition, then the two different kinds of meditation become one meditation, the one and only meditation. And it is total and complete all the time. Because there is nothing which is not innocent within oneself which puts up a barrier to this state of communion. So mindfulness is very important, very, very important, all the time, to pay attention mindfully, which, remember, is not paying attention in order to gain a result. Because when you pay attention truly mindfully, there are no barriers, there are no doors. The finite and the infinite are one. In this state of mindfulness, you actually experience here and now the meaning of immortality. Because if you are completely attentive, completely mindful of the immediate now, when it does happen to you, you will discover something which I'm just going to say, which is quite true. You will not be able to see a change, because you will be completely one with that perpetual changing process of the universe. And if you are completely at one with it, you don't see it as a change. We see it and experience it as a change because there is a time lag in our own consciousness. That time lag disappears. If the time lag disappears, you are conscious in the timeless state. And in that state of timelessness, there is the realization of immortality.